Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you tuned in this morning. This morning we'll be talking about agriculture and how we go about meeting the world's need for food. It is generally accepted that to meet the growing demands of simple population growth and the fact that as people become more affluent, their demands for food change and increase, food production has to grow at a steady pace. However, we also know that most productive land around the world is already in production. There is also a serious question about availability of water. So given those things, how will it be possible to meet this increased need for food? That is the question we'll be taking up this morning and on some future programs here on Focus with guests that are here on the campus to talk about these very topics. This morning, in this first hour of Focus, we'll be talking with ag policy analyst Charles Benbrook. He now operates an international consulting service, Benbrook Consulting Services, has clients around the world, including the World Bank, the United Nations, the organization Bread for the World, also here at home, groups like Consumers Union, the American Farmland Trust, the World Wildlife Fund. Before setting up his consulting business, he spent a number of years as the executive director of the Board on Agriculture of the National Research Council and National Academy of Sciences. And he is here as part of a series, Agriculture's Changing Role in the Global Ecosystem, which is sponsored by the World Food and Sustainable Agriculture Program on the U of I campus. And he's giving a talk in the MillerCom series tonight, 7 o'clock. The title for his talk is Malthus Meets the Green Giant, Biotechnology and the World Food Supply. And as is the case with all of these MillerCom events, they are free and open to the public, and anybody who would like to attend is welcome to do that. But we're fortunate to have him with us here in the studio so that folks who probably could not come here to hear the speech can hear what he has to say. His answer to that question, how is that will we meet this increased need for food, is that technology certainly supplies an answer. However, he does have some criticism of some of the directions that research and development has taken in agriculture, particularly in this area of genetically engineered crops. So we'll try and see if we could sort some of these issues out. It's a very large and complex area, but I'll ask them questions. And for people who are listening, there is also, of course, that possibility to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, David, for
being here. Are we starting out with the assumption that we're using just about as much land as there is possible, so that, what we really have to do is one way or another increase yield on existing land?
That's right, David. I think anyone that drives down the highway in the summer, certainly in the Midwest and in most of the world, sees that crops growing on good, flat, productive soils. The remaining land that isn't in agricultural production tends to have one or more environmental or natural resource constraint. There's certainly land on steep hillsides, but it's hard to hold the soil. There's land in areas that are prone to drought. There's land that has certain mineral imbalances. So it really is true that for most countries, all of the productive land that doesn't have a lot of natural resource constraints is already in production. And certainly agriculture is tapping all the available water for irrigation that can be had.
Hmm. Well, it seems that let's go sort of to your main criticism of this, of sort of a major direction that R&D and agricultural has taken, taking advantage of the possibility to do genetic manipulation of crops. And you talk about a couple of things, and certainly farmers are familiar with them, and we have talked about some of these issues here on the program. Basically, doing genetic modification of crops to make them either more resistant to insects, so there you can get more yield that way, or also making them more resistant to one of the most popular herbicides, so that, again, the idea being that you, if you can, there the idea being that if you can cut farmers' input costs, that saves them money, and also that it's a more effective sort of program of weed control. If you know that You can plant your soybeans, and then you can come over with a herbicide that will kill everything, all of the weeds, get rid of everything that you don't want, and leave the soybeans alone. On the face of it, it would seem that those two things are very significant advancements. However, I think you raised some questions about whether indeed this is sustainable on the one hand, and is it really going to mean more money in the pocket of farmers in the long run?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard for farmers and society and scientists and all of us to really keep in perspective what biotechnology already means and is going to mean in the future for medicine, for agriculture, for the energy industry, for many sectors of our economy. Biotechnology is without doubt one of the most, you know, profound revolutions in how we do science in agriculture, in human health, and in the pharmaceutical industry. It's a powerful set of tools that allow us to understand what's going on at a cellular and genetic level, and also helps us understand what goes on in broader systems, like how a person interacts with their diet and their lifestyle and their workplace in determining health. Likewise, on the farm, biotechnology not only is leading to new production inputs, and we'll talk about some of those today, but it's also leading to much better understanding about what's going on a farm, which is really it's a biological organism, and the what grows there and how well it grows and how much money the farmer ends up at the end of the year is a function of how healthy that system is. So the hype about biotechnology revolutionizing science and being of profound significance is indisputable. It's true. But what a lot of people hear about biotechnology in you know, dramatically changing the food system and you know, altering the very essence of life, you know, probably has only a modest connection to reality at this point. And I think that the reason that many people are concerned about biotechnology, which is a whole suite of new approaches to science, to accomplishing various goals, either in agriculture or in medicine, is that many people and companies are trying to use biotechnology in the same way that some past technologies were used, and in ways that are likely to really sow the seeds of their own destruction, if you will. Biotechnology. You know, it's like the Force in the Star Wars movies. It has a dark side and clearly a positive side. And right now there's a sort of a struggle underway to see how biotechnology is going to be utilized in agriculture. And I think farmers are very much caught in the middle of the enthusiasm in the private sector, particularly in the pesticide and seed industries, to exploit biotechnology as a way to bring new products onto the market, some of which are indeed helping the farmer, but others are maybe not such a big help. And I think we should definitely talk a little bit about the difference between the hype about biotechnology and the reality. And let me just say to all the farmers out there, having spent my hours in the seat, if I could buy a technology that was as good as what some people claim current biotechnologies are, I'd sure be the first in line at the store to bring them onto my farm. But you know, I think we have to separate a little bit the wheat from the chaff on these technologies and ask really how are they performing, what are they costing, and who's paying some of the indirect costs that are associated with bringing them into our agricultural system.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with ag policy analyst Charles Benbrook. He now has his own international consulting business called Benbrook Consulting Services. Before that, between 1984 and 1990, he was at the National Research Council, National Academy of Sciences, where he was executive director of their board on agriculture. And then before that, he also worked fact for the Committee on Agriculture in the U.S. House of Representatives. And he's here in Champaign-Urbana to speak on this topic here we're talking about today, biotechnology and the world food supply. This is a MillerCom event, and it's tonight. And, of course, as we continue to talk, you're welcome to call in with questions, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about these two things as the people who are listening to us, I'm sure a lot of them, if they're involved in agriculture, they're involved in corn and beans. Here in Illinois, that's two really important crops. And why don't we just talk about the corn,
okay.
the BT corn. This is something that, again, maybe people have heard about, and sort of the thumbnail sketch is that a corn plant has been designed that has in it, it produces a natural kind of insecticide. Mm-hmm. So that the pests that would attack the corn, they'll come along, they'll eat the corn, they'll eat the insecticide, they will die. Seems like a great deal because we have this particular pest. It's the western corn rootworm, and it's a real problem for people who grow corn. And otherwise, you would have to go out, you'd have to spray pesticide in the field. Mm-hmm. That's expensive. There are concerns about the residue and so forth. So if you can get the plant to do that all by itself, seems like a great deal. Is there some downside to this?
Well, first of all, David, there's a couple of insect pests that Midwestern farmers, and in fact, farmers that grow corn around the world deal with. One is the European corn borer, and it's a periodic pest. Some years it's quite bad. Other years it's not so bad. And for most of the last five decades in the Midwest, corn farmers have not applied insecticides in an attempt to manage the corn borer. It's because this insect spends a lot of its life inside the stalk. There's no way to get the spray onto it. And there really haven't been a lot of technologies that have been cost-effective in dealing with the European corn borer. This changed when scientists discovered a mechanism to breed into the corn plant this Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, toxin, which is, it's a natural insecticide, comes from soil microorganisms. And what happens is the corn plant expresses this BT. It literally manufactures the BT in the cells of the growing corn plant, so that as the European corn borer goes through its life cycle and moves up through the plant and munches on the leaves, it receives a lethal dose of this toxin and is controlled. It's an effective technology, and it's really taken the Corn Belt by storm. The problem with this approach, however, is that insects have an enormous capacity to adapt to whatever measures Mother Nature or mankind, throw against them. Insects are inventive, and we have had a problem in agriculture, ever since cultivation began, with the ability of insects and diseases to adapt and respond. And so for 50 years, one of the dominant problems in American agriculture has been the evolution of resistance in insects to the major pesticides used against them. It really started with, remember, DDT. A lot of people have heard about the environmental problems associated with DDT and other chemicals that fell within the class chlorinated hydrocarbons, but don't know that the reason that those chemicals really fell out of favor and use dropped precipitously, it wasn't regulation. It was that they didn't work anymore because the insects had adapted resistance to them. And in fact, insects, the genetic change is smart, and then sort of remembers how to adapt around chemicals that are closely related, so that it might have taken 5 years for resistance to the first chlorinated hydrocarbon insecticide, and then it would take three to the next, and then two, and then in later generations, almost anything that the chemical industry was able to bring forward to control resistant populations wouldn't work in that family of chemistry. That's a lesson that's been repeated all over the world in virtually every class of insects. It's part of what science knows about managing insects. Along comes biotechnology, and clearly a powerful set of new tools that allows us to do some things that we've never been able to do in the past. But people are forgetting this lesson that if you expose an insect to heavy selection pressure from any one control technique or tactic or input, that insect is probably going to develop resistance and adapt around it reasonably quickly. This is, of course, the big controversy about BT corn in the U.S. and indeed in most parts of the world, is the concern that by utilizing biotechnology to breed the BT gene into crops, we've got whole fields of corn that are their little mini pesticide factories, and they're going to expose the insects to such a high and continuous dose of BT that they'll fairly quickly adapt around it. And the loss of BT as an effective insecticide, it's the safest insecticide known to man to control this large class of insects we call the lepidopterans, which are really any insect that goes through a moth stage, and it's some of our most damaging ones. So the potential to sort of burn out BT for all of agriculture for all time is an enormous issue, and that's why this debate goes on.
Yeah. I guess I misspoke. I think I was thinking about the other insect problem was
the
rootworm that was learning to get around rotation.
Right.
But I guess that what that is it's another example of the way that insects can adapt to strategies that people have used to try to deal with the insects.
Exactly. And let me say for the listeners in the Midwest that what has been learned about the Western corn rootworm and its adaptation to the long effective corn soybean rotation is actually almost an unprecedented scientific discovery. It's one of the first instances where an insect has adapted to what we call a cultural practice, not a chemical, but a cultural practice. And this is of enormous consequence because the lesson of the Western court rootworm that started unfolding in Illinois in 1986 and became a much more serious problem in 1993, and then a really devastating problem where a lot of farmers lost a significant part of their crop in 1996. That lesson has taught us that sort of the laws of nature don't discriminate. Farmers that rely solely on either a cultural practice or a chemical practice or a genetic practice are likely to find that sooner or later the insects are going to adapt around it.
Hmm. Well, not very long ago, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to interview a scientist who was involved in the development of this corn, and I asked him about this very question about how long did he think it would take before the insects would, or what sort of potential was for them to develop resistance to the BT, and he said, well, the company has a strategy for dealing with this, but I think that in the end he was honest enough to say, well, we do know that sooner or later, maybe in a few years, this product isn't going to work anymore. And, of course, their ultimate answer would be, well, we'll develop something new.
Right.
So again, it seems that this goes along that line that says, okay, well, how do we solve our problems with technology? And if the technology comes to a point where it doesn't work anymore, well, we'll just invent some new technology and keep going like that. Mm-hmm. So I guess one question is, do you think that products like this have been oversold? I mean, have farmers really, have manufacturers and other people promoting it been up front with farmers and saying, yes, this may work really well today, but this is not a long-term solution to this problem?
No, I don't think that they've been up front, and I also think that they've really been quite misguided as companies that you know are responsible to shareholders to show a return, and not just for a year or two. These technologies cost a lot of money to develop and bring to market, and if they only work well enough to hold any kind of meaningful market share for 3 or 4 or 5 years, they're not going to pay back the money that it costs to bring them to market. And I think there's two important points that we need to talk about a little bit about what's at stake in the loss of BT. Okay, first of all, the you know companies that are developing the technology, they argue that, oh, not to worry, we'll find a new strain or a new enterotoxin or endotoxin or whatever, or we'll stack genes and we'll mix things and we will continue to innovate around the adaptation in the insect populations that we're trying to control. This is exactly what doctors have been saying for 30 years about antibiotics. We've got strong drug discovery programs. We're watching very carefully the development of resistance to our common antibiotics, and we'll innovate around this problem. I don't know how many people have had a trip to the hospital lately or visited a friend or a loved one, but there are a lot of worried people in hospitals now because we're down to one or perhaps two effective antibiotics now to control some of the most common sources of infection that it's hard to avoid, you know, even in hospitals. We are really seriously running up against our ability to keep effective antibiotics available for treating common infectious diseases. And this is despite the enormous energy and investment that's being made by the pharmaceutical industry in trying to discover antibiotics. Well, in controlling Lepidopteran insects, BT is basically like the whole class of antibiotics for treating human infectious diseases. BT is a class of related microorganisms that produce a variety of endotoxins, which are very biologically active against just certain species of insects. They have virtually no effect on mammals. That's why they're so safe, or on birds or on fish, which is why BT is such an ideal insecticide. It's really the only broadly applicable, commercially viable, safe way of managing this enormous class of insects, which probably trigger two-thirds of the insecticide applications in the world. And the prospect of losing BT as a pest management tool is analogous to losing antibiotics as a way of treating infectious diseases. And any company, any agricultural system that approaches the prospect of the loss of BT as, oh, well, it's no big deal, is really doing us a major disservice.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. They're both in Champaign, and we'll start with line one. Hello.
Hi. It's interesting you bring up the issue of antibiotics. There's a lot of evidence, I think, that many of the problems we're having are really caused by the massive uses of antibiotics in animal agriculture, because we're using a lot of the same antibiotics, using them in massive quantities because of the confinement management that is used in contemporary agriculture, and that, you know, even if you reduce human usage and abuse of these antibiotics, you're still going to have the problem with, creating super strains of bacteria because these same antibiotics are being used in agriculture.
Yes, I think that's right. And there's, as you no doubt know, there's a tremendous amount of work going on in the Centers for Disease Control and other parts of government to try to really better understand and deal with this problem. But you know, there's sort of a common theme behind the effort to maintain the effectiveness of antibiotics and the effort to maintain the effectiveness of BT as an insecticide and the herbicide glyphosate or Roundup as a weed management tool. And that is how you use new technologies within systems makes an enormous difference in how well the technologies perform and also whether the technologies trigger side effects. You know, there's an old rule of thumb that, you know, if you sort of go overboard in doing anything, you can get into problems. And, you know, biotechnology is the same. You can't have too much of a good thing.
Well, thank you. I just think that, you know, if we continue on with the current massive use of antibiotics in agriculture, you know, with animals, that, you know, we're not going to solve the problem or ameliorate the problem just by using or, you know, cutting back in use with humans. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go on to the next caller, line two. They're also in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I've got two questions. The first question has to do with the statement that all the agricultural land is already taken up. But isn't it true that a lot of our agricultural land, especially in the United States, is devoted to feeding livestock? And if that were freed up, we could feed quite a few more people.
Good point, definitely an accurate one. The best estimates that I've read are that if you devote an acre of Illinois land to growing corn or soybeans, which are fed to you know, poultry or pigs or cattle, that you can increase the calories that a human being, you know, derives from that acre of corn or soybeans by about a factor of 7 to 1 by consuming the corn or the beans in some direct form, as of course people in many other cultures do. So it's not that we can necessarily increase the production of corn and soybeans 7 times in Illinois, but by changing the design of the food system and the portion of food that's fed to livestock and the portion of calories that we derive from livestock, we certainly can have a big impact. The other important point is that we still have close to 30 million acres in the United States enrolled in a very important program, the so-called Conservation Reserve Program, which we've spent as a country, you know, $18-19 billion on since it began in 1985. And that land is being, you know, held in conserving uses, typically not harvested on an annual basis. And the, you know, the day will come when that some of that land returns to production, but it's certainly not as productive as the, you know, common acre out here in around Champaign, Urbana, Illinois.
Yeah, and I understand there's a lot of distortion as far as the how agriculture is allowed to exist in a lot of developing countries, as far as, you know, they're having to produce, for example, bananas or sugarcane when they could be producing food for their people. But my second question, and then I'll hang up, has to do with an article in the LA Times Sunday called "Science, Hype, and Profit, a Perilous Mix," where they point out that the RAND Corporation and Stanford University analysts both think that there are about 25% more doctorates in science and engineering than the economy can absorb, and it's causing this really heated competition for scarce resources. And because of Congress and the commercialization of research, it's causing real problems, and particularly in the biological sciences. And I was wondering if you read the article and maybe have a comment along those lines.
I actually did see the article. I didn't get a chance to read it fully. I was moving through one airport or another, I believe, at the time. It is a sort of a triggers the thought in my mind that if there were an oversupply of scientists and engineers and technologists in a given area, one way to deal with that would be to strengthen intellectual property laws and patent laws and make it easier to extract from the economy a return for new discoveries and new technologies. And in fact, I think that that's part of what's driving some of the big changes in agriculture is that biotechnology has, from the very beginning, been both a boon for scientists and a incredibly exciting area for discovery, but it's also been a heyday for lawyers and patent attorneys and the U.S. Patent Office because there's been so much effort and interest in trying to establish a patent position and protection for some of these discoveries.
I have several other callers, and I want to make sure that we get to them. But I want to raise a question. Maybe you could talk about it for a little bit at least. I guess it's my understanding, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the changes that has occurred in the field of ag research is that it used to be that much more of research was done in the public sector, primarily in universities, and that more and more the private sector has become much more important, and it seems that the balance has shifted to private companies doing research, and we shouldn't be surprised, there is a profit motive. They're interested in making money. Has that I hesitate to ask such a bare-faced question as is that good or bad? But what are consequences of the fact that so much of this research now is taking place in the for-profit arena?
Well, it's up to perhaps the judgment of history to tell whether it's good or bad, but it's certainly happening. Beginning in the early 1980s, certainly at the federal level and in most states, the public investment in agricultural research and education and technology development started to slide, and the dominance of the private sector began to assert itself. And today, the end of the 1990s, there's no question but that the private sector is really driving the major areas of new science and technology development in agriculture. And the public sector, universities like this one, the faculty members are having a hard time just keeping up and understanding what the new technologies are that are coming from the private sector. Public university scientists are responsible to people in the state and the farmers to try to understand these technologies and provide guidance on how to integrate them into the systems that are already part of, say, Illinois agriculture. And just doing that has become an enormously difficult task given the proliferation of new technologies. And as a result, faculty members who, 20 years ago could be doing, cutting-edge research to discover the scientific basis for a new way to manage weeds with fewer chemicals, for example. They don't have the opportunity to do that work now because they're forced to sort of deal with all the new products that are on the market and problems with them and how to integrate them into systems, because sometimes the new technologies themselves are not fully compatible.
Let's go back to the phones to, again, Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I just read a book, The Red Queen, by Matt Ridley, and it describes, I don't know if you've read it or not, but the effect of as the faster we go and the more we find solutions to these problems, the more the problems stay right with us. In other words, they the analogy is the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. As she runs across the landscape moves with her.
Yeah, we use the term treadmill often in talking about agricultural technologies.
Treadmill?
Yeah.
Well, it seems that the more biotechnology finds solutions to these problems, the lock and key system is, we find a lock and the parasite finds a key. And it's a constant battle, and the faster we work on it, the faster they find the keys, and make the keys. So and the more food we produce, the more people we feed, and the more population we have, and it just, where does this end? Like, can I leave that with you?
Yeah, well, I think it's not only an important observation, but it's one of the great challenges of our day. And I think the message that I'm going to bring to campus tonight is that what we need to do is look back at some of the lessons we've learned about how past agricultural technologies have performed and what kind of impacts they've had on the full health of our society, you know, both the farmers and the people that eat food and the environment and water quality, and see if we can't get a little smarter about how we apply technology, because the recurrent theme, if you look back at past agricultural technologies that have really gotten into trouble, it's not so much an inherent failing or problem with the technology, but it's actually how we have ended up using the technology. And it's really the case of BT corn that we talked about a little bit earlier. It's a perfect example. BT corn is a tremendous technical innovation, and one can envision ways that tool could be added to our existing toolkit for managing insect pests in the Midwest. And it could remain an important part of the practices that farmers can draw upon. But if we cover the Midwest with BT corn for 4 or 5 years in a row, we might as well just throw that hammer away, because it's not going to be useful anymore. So what we need to learn as a society is that we have to stop thinking about technology as a progression of silver bullets, and instead use technology and knowledge to manage systems, and including our own health, in ways that's more effective.
Right. I mean, I guess the question is: are we really making progress? Or are we just? I mean, we're filling our toolbox with all these tools to solve these problems, and I guess as things go on, maybe we could pull these tools out of the toolbox at a later time, and they'll work again.
Well,
they might become obsolete. And if, like you said, if we put BT corn all over the Midwest in 4 years, it's no good. Well, maybe 25 years from now, it'll work again.
That's possible. Although entomologists have found that the resistant genes that have come into insect populations to, you know, chlorinated hydrocarbons, for example, which were used heavily in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, those resistant genes are still part of the current populations. There is not much of a genetic load, as the entomologists say, in carrying those forward. So it may be quite a long time before some of these technologies can be brought back
again
to use. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's only a speck in time, 25, 50 years or something. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Okay. Next up is Westfield, line number 4. Hello. It's a caller there on line 4, Westfield. Well, maybe not. Let's try Princeton, line number 3. Yes, hello.
I'm sorry that I got in maybe partway through your conversation, but one of the callers called and commented upon, or maybe you commented upon, the extra 30 million acres that are set aside for the CRP. As it turns out, that's probably a pretty high percentage of fairly fragile land in the United States. And I think the problem in all this really boils down to one simple thing, and that is, as we look at the world's population having about 75% being unable to even afford a telephone, how are they going to be able to afford some of the things that we're trying to produce and provide to the, you know, to the their lifestyles.
Yeah, that's a very good point. There's quite a debate emerging on this very question of the ability of the developing world, where there are some very acute needs for food. The ability of the developing world to benefit from the supply of foodstuffs that are in fact depressing prices in many countries around the world. And the reality is that back when the world community got together in the last round of trade talks and the GATT was passed, the developed world persuaded the developing countries that at the time depended fairly heavily on food aid that if they would go along with an opening up of markets and placing greater reliance on trade to meet shortfalls in food production, that the developed world would step up to the plate, and in years when market prices went very high for, you know, wheat, corn, rice, soybeans, the basic staples of the human diet in many, many countries, that the developed world would increase their food aid and make up for this shortfall. In reality, since 1991, food aid has dropped by about 50% on a global basis. And so many countries that have been dependent on both imports and food aid find themselves in 1999 in a very precarious situation where they feel that their food supply and their ability to keep enough food coming into their countries is truly insecure, and I think we're certainly not going to in the United States be able to substantially change that equation, because the U.S. is, I think it's about 30th among the developing countries in willingness to support for international development and foreign affairs in general, and a high percentage, a progressively high percentage of our the money that Congress is willing to appropriate for international programs are going for peacekeeping and dealing with crises and building institutions of civil society and not for food aid. So there's no really bright side to that equation.
Well, that's just the challenge. As it turns out, I'm in agriculture and involved in food production. We actually export pigs around the world. Of course, that's been affected by the Southeast Asian economies and so on. But I think the big challenge, as it may be, that is going to be a decision as to who's going to step up to do the missionary work. Because these people, I think right now agriculture has exceeded the ability to produce at a price that people can afford to produce it at, and yet people can still afford to purchase it at. And I don't think we have the inability to produce food to supply the growing population. But I think as a producer of agricultural products, we're challenged with trying to do it at a profitable level without being subsidized. And they have the challenge of purchasing it without being subsidized or without having it subsidized so they can. So we're kind of in a catch-22, but I think we're going to have to continue to provide this research, and all that's really being driven by profits from companies like DuPont and Monsanto and Rohm Palanque. And I mean, these are multinational or international companies that have huge, huge profits evolving from the research, and to continue to provide new products at a cheaper cost. That money has to be spent to do such. Any comments there?
Yeah, caller, you made you brought up an important issue. You know. Are, in fact, all of the dollars being invested in biotechnology and behind the integration of the once independent pesticide and seed industries, are they really bringing to the farmer, to yourself, technologies that are making it possible for you to, you know, increase yields and lower your costs? Ask yourself, what did you pay for your old 286 computer, and what could it do in terms of managing information?
And, well, I think there's only two things that society is really gotten more bang for their buck, and that is a computer and in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if we're being the missionary to provide that, but I can only tell you that the gross income is continuing to decline, the costs of production are continuing to increase, so the margins, of course, are being squeezed. And the results are very real in terms of the benefits of what's being used. It all boils down to economics. If it works and it's profitable, it will be utilized. Mm-hmm. The thing is, I think the companies are being driven to get a higher and higher percentage of that opportunity that they're gaining from the research. And, of course, we're being encouraged to spend the money to it's kind of a catch-22, and you kind of chase your tail a little bit. But we have to make decisions that are going to provide more profit to our operations, and while the margins may be lower, that's kind of the squeeze we're in. It's kind of a capitalistic approach, if you might. So thanks very much for your time.
Sure, thank you.
I'd like to just build on this caller's comments to make this point before our time lapses, and invite anyone to come by this evening, because a good portion of my talk is devoted to looking at what's happened as a result of biotechnology to the relative profitability of the different sectors of agriculture. The caller spoke of the squeeze that the production sector, you know, has experienced, you know, not just in recent years, but really going back 20 years now. By any indicator, the production sector of agriculture has slipped in its returns to assets, in its profits as a percent of revenue. And I'll be presenting data this evening that shows, you know, how other sectors of the economy of the agricultural economy and food system are performing. And if in both the seed and pesticide industries and the food processing industries, profits on the order of 5 to 7, 8 or 9% of revenues on an annual basis are common and expected. And in fact, that's why there's so much investment capital flowing into those sectors of agriculture. The problem that we have today and the real challenge is it's not that some companies in some sectors are making more money than they did in the past and are really investing heavily in new technology. That's a good thing. The problem that we have today is that part of our system is in fact not sharing in the benefits of some of these changes and is in fact growing weaker. Our U.S. food system is never going to be stronger than its weakest link, and we have to pay more attention, I think, to the economic forces that are putting such incredible pressures on producers so that they've got to cover 2,000 acres to you know, support a family. That's just probably not a sound way to do business.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop. But for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our guest, Charles Benbrook. He'll be giving a talk tonight dealing with many of these issues as part of the MillerCom series tonight, 7 o'clock, room 112, Greg Hall on the U of I campus. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, David.